This is Julian Rubinstein, and welcome to News Roast. Now, before this episode, I wanted to tell you that this is episode 11 of 12 of Series 2. We would love to make Series 3. We've got some outstanding guests, and we might even do some records in the United States. But in order for us to do that, we really, really, really need your help now. Please, please, please rate, review, and share the podcast. Thank you very much. Hello and welcome to News Roast. My name is Julian Rubinstein.
And my name is Hayden Prowse.
And as you well know by now, we are the guys that give you three courses of metaphorical conversation.
Three courses of metaphorical conversation. Getting straight to it, this week we have a very good friend of ours and an incredibly impressive journalist, author now, hacker. Can I call you a hacker as well?
Cultural hacker.
Legally, I prefer not. Yes, that one's fine.
Cultural hacker. James Bull, welcome to News Roast.
The absolute legend that is. This is a man who worked at WikiLeaks for a while, didn't like the cut of Assange's jib, got out, was instrumental in breaking the Snowden story. I mean, seriously, one of the most intelligent people we know, and younger than us, which we find deeply, deeply frustrating. Mm.
I mean, I'm working on getting older. I'll try harder.
You try, but you've got a baby face. You've got such a like calm and lovely demeanor. It's depressing, isn't it, Hayden?
It is depressing.
I mean, he's also got any wrinkles on his face.
He's also written books, which I haven't done, and I'm no longer of the age where it's de facto impressive to have written a book. Mm. I remember when I was 26, I was like, if I write a book right now, just everyone will be impressed no matter what.
The thing is, Hayden, you've basically always wanted to be a struggling down-and-out novelist in Paris.
I've been writing a book for about 12 years.
See, that's the best way to be doing it. None of this finishing it.
Jay, you may have written one book. I've almost written three, okay?
Yeah,
how do you feel about that?
I've written three.
Yeah, there
okay,
you go.
Fuck it.
James's books, his most recent one on post-truth. What's the entire title of the book?
It is Post-Truth, How Bullshit Conquered the World.
Yeah.
Nice and cheery, you know, optimistic.
Which is going to be a kind of running theme for today's News Roast, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, even though there's barely any fake news or post-truth about, I've somehow managed to come up with some of it.
So before we get into our starter, James, just for our audience, you know, we've spoken before, but can you just clarify sort of your relationship with WikiLeaks, how that happened, you know, the relationship with Assange, how that sort of soured?
So, I mean, you know, I like to say that I fell out with Assange before it was cool. I was there for a while in 2010. I sort of met him when I was working for a journalistic nonprofit, and he literally, the evening I met him, gave me a USB stick with 400,000 Iraq war documents on it, which became the Iraq war logs, and we made an hour of TV for dispatchers for Channel 4 with it. And I kind of got a 2 a.m. message from him, sort of on a secure instant messaging thing, you know, glorified WhatsApp, kind of saying, if you want to work on the next one, which was the state cables, and we'd sort of picked up that they existed, you're going to have to work for me. And so off I dash for, you know, what turned out to be about 3 or 4 months. It wasn't a long time, sort of up with Assange to this country house, sort of in hiding at the time, working on these 250,000 embassy cables. But, you know, this may be a bit of, you know, news, bit of a revelation, but he's quite a difficult guy, Julian Assange.
No.
You know, can be a bit unlikable.
I've never heard that.
Bit problematic as well. So
what was it that made you eventually leave WikiLeaks?
So he got increasingly shady in terms of how he was dealing with the allegations of sexual assault and rape that had come out of Sweden. He was sort of deliberately letting it conflate with WikiLeaks rather than just being his own private life. You know, at one point he kind of did a, I'm not saying it's the CIA, but I'm not saying that either. Mm. And that kind of sicked a real online hate mob onto the two women who were at the centre of it. And then also he got very shady to do with information that got handed to a key ally of Putin, someone who he knew had been photographed leaving the interior ministry in Belarus, which is a dictatorship. And the dictator came on the next day saying that he had cables that showed the opposition were US stooges. And Assange's response was just to deny that the guy concerned had ever had any cables. And so it couldn't possibly be true. It was just a smear.
Wow.
And I knew the guy had cables. And the way I knew that was because before I knew who he was, and at Assange's order, direct order,
yeah,
I had given him cables.
Fucking hell. Where were the cables from originally?
So they were from the US embassy in Belarus.
Right, so they're part of the embassy leaks.
Yeah, it was part of the embassy
leaks. And
he
had fed them to a dictator.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that. Is that...
So I don't think Assange knew they were going to go to this dictator. Wow. But when his good friend sort of appeared to have done that, his response was just to lie and pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was kind of, you know, parting of the ways. Like, if you could put up with that, you could put up with too much.
And then let's just talk through your involvement in the Snowden case, because I know, you know, there's ongoing stuff with it, but it's one of the most, you know, prominent cases of the last 50 years, really, of, you know, just gigantic whistleblowing.
Yeah, so I got involved with the Snowden leaks really quite early. Glenn Greenwald and Ewan McCaskill, my then Guardian colleague, were on a plane to Hong Kong when I heard about it, and I basically got told by the then Guardian editor, Alan Rusbidger, to hop a plane to New York and be ready to work on a big story. This was sort of 7 p.m. on a Friday night, and, you know, the next Wednesday we pressed go on the first Snowden story. And so it was a good sort of 18 months of my life just working on this stuff. And while you're working on it, of course, you can't pick up a phone, you can't email, you can't do anything like that to have a meeting. You were having to fly. So you'd go to New York because we had to destroy any copies of the stuff that we had in this country. You know, GCHQ came in and supervised that.
Just for people who don't know about this is GCHQ coming into the offices of The Guardian, going down, demanding the hard drives and literally physically destroying them.
Yeah, watching as Guardian staff destroyed it. They wouldn't touch it, but they made sure everything was so thoroughly wiped. It was ridiculous. But through various means, we had a copy in America as well. I will say absolutely no more on that. So
I just love the idea of GCHQ coming in and being like, look, we're not going to touch it ourselves, mate. I mean, if you want to destroy it in front of us, that is entirely up to you. But if you don't, what we'll do is we'll just go indict you to a country. We can put a black hood over your head and maybe do some things that we usually do to, you know, problematic Muslims.
I mean, you know, I wasn't there, but that's, I couldn't know if that was verbatim. But what was sort of crazy.
So did they not know you had the copy?
No, we told them that we had the copy.
Oh, but
we still said this is completely useless. It will only look stupid.
Why did they?
Because they're British.
What was the thinking?
Classic British compromise. I think they didn't want to have to do a police raid on a major newspaper,
right.
But they needed to be able to say they'd done something.
I see, yeah.
And so it was this mess of a situation. But sort of what's interesting for me is, you know, we did this story and changed US law. Obama came out and talked about it, and we won the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. And then in the UK,
hold on,
what's happened? Ta, you know, get a brag in.
make humble brag.
But in the UK, what's happened is we sort of learned just this week, we're actually still under police investigation as journalists.
You are under police investigation, personally.
Yeah.
We found
out about that because a journalist reported it. We knew that we'd been under investigation at the time, but 4 years on, that they're still doing this with something of such obvious public interest that it's been acknowledged by the president as having some of that.
It's crazy.
You know, it's quite a chilling thing. It sends a warning to other people who would want to sort of do something, and that's discouraging kind of whistleblowers and as well as reporters.
Have you been scoping out any nice comfy embassies you might be able to escape to, should it all hit the fan?
Frankly, I think embassies have got very passé.
Right,
you know.
What are you going to go for?
Last year's trend.
Okay, come around my ass if you want, mate.
Ta.
Yeah. Joel, what would you do if you were looking for a local business?
Look on a website.
You would Google it and you would find the website, right?
I might Google it, I might Safari it, who knows? But the point is, every small business needs a website.
You need a website. If you don't have a website, how am I going to find out about your store?
Millions of people go online to search for local businesses every day.
Does your business show up when I Google it?
When you create a website on WordPress.com, you make it easier for your customers to find you, to connect with you.
To connect with you. WordPress is the lick. Everyone knows WordPress is the place to make a website.
So to hear how you can help them,
Your business needs not just an online home, it needs WordPress.com websites.
It does. You don't need experience setting up a WordPress site. It's super easy and it guides you through the process from start to finish. Look, even Jollyin could do it.
Well, I mean, look, if they can help me do it, they can help anyone
do
it.
They take care of the technical stuff for you, Jollyin. So it's easy for you to get your site up and running as fast as possible so you can go off and do another podcast.
Bro, do you know what?
Yeah. Yes.
Their customer team is the absolute dons.
So you set up a website and there's a customer support team available to chat to you. You know, they're available 24 hours a day, mate, Monday through to Friday and weekends.
Yes, at weekends.
Yes, at weekends.
It's at weekends
and
as well.
24 hours a day. That is actually pretty good.
Listen, the plan starts from just $4 a month,
and all WordPress plans include a custom domain name for the life of the plan. So you could have jollyinisatotalninny.com forever, mate.
That would be an amazing small business. But come see why 28% of all websites run on WordPress.
Get started today with 15% off any plan purchase.
15%?
15%, mate. Go to wordpress.com/roast. That's wordpress.com/roast to create your website and find the plan that's right for you.
That's wordpress.com/roast. 15% off just for our listeners. wordpress.com/roast. Mate, every small business needs a website, mate.
Gotta have it.
So, James, what have you brought for your metaphorical starter?
Sir, I have brought along everyone's favourite dinner guest, Donald Trump.
Another man who's sending interesting messages via Twitter.
Oh, yeah. So the news today, he's just been retweeting Britain First videos.
I think I'm going to save my ire, because I said to myself on the way in, I'm going to do it for a minute and really say what I think, but like, I don't want to get too lost in it, because it is driving me absolutely mental.
So, if you're writing a book about fake news, about post-truth and about bullshit, Donald Trump ends up being your protagonist pretty much.
Yeah.
He's very good at creating it and he's very good at shouting the words fake news, mainly at CNN. But what's kind of interesting is just how often he either creates it or spreads it. Right down to this stuff from Britain First today, which if people haven't seen, he retweeted three posts from the deputy leader of Britain First, which is ostensibly a far-right political party, but it's mainly kind of an online hate group.
And if you follow the Britain First Twitter feed or Paul Golding's Twitter feed, it's basically just video after video of Muslims either getting beaten up or falling over. It's the most ridiculous racist Twitter feed you've ever seen in your entire life. It's insane.
Yeah. And that's exactly how they work on Facebook. I'd actually studied this group, and they use things like, you know, Muslims are cruel to animals, halal slaughter is awful, or the burqa ban means, you know, people could hide bombs. It's not subtle race baiting.
No,
it's pretty blatant.
It's the most overt race baiting.
And, you know, this group's quite, what's quite interesting in the fake news sense of things is Trump retweeted these three really inflammatory videos, and one of them sort of is captioned, Muslim migrant beats up Dutch man on crutches.
Mm.
The guy wasn't Muslim and wasn't a migrant.
Yeah.
So the person kind of best at making and spreading fake news isn't, you know, CNN and isn't even Fox News. It's frankly Donald Trump.
Do you think this is, as many people are starting to suggest, a very deliberate strategy?
It was easier to think it was deliberate during the campaign when he kind of was just trying to outgun Hillary Clinton, you know, a more qualified woman, frankly, in, you know, in CV terms. I think by the time you look at it now, it looks like someone who is just born as a bullshitter and born as a rabble-rouser. He will say just completely stupid lies, you know, like claiming he had the biggest inauguration crowd. Why claim that? That's got no meaning. You know, claiming that the election that he won was so rigged that it had 3 million false votes in. I mean, if you're claiming an election has 3 million false votes in it, what you're calling for is for it to be invalidated.
I suppose what I mean by that is that I, just before we came on air, was looking at a tweet from Brendan Cox, who's the husband of murdered MP Jo Cox, whose murderer, just before she was killed, shouted Britain First. And the retweeting of far-right extremist groups is not a hugely new thing. You know, after Charlottesville, he sort of made, you know, clear remarks about the alt-right and the alt-left. But this is new, obviously, retweeting Britain First. But I suppose, I mean, do you think that, you know, as many people are starting to, that this man is a fascist? Or is he just trying to sow seeds of dissent and play to his base?
I think he likes playing to his base. And, you know, his issues are he thinks Muslims are dangerous and that problem needs to be solved in kind of the most appalling, crude ways of, you know, travel bans and all of this kind of stuff. He's anti-immigration. He's quite anti-Muslim, except when he goes and meets those kind of Saudi royals and when he gets pampered and they're nice, that's fine. But he's anti-immigration, he's anti-Muslim, and he kind of quite nationalist in the really old sense of, you know, make the country great again, we're number one. So he's certainly an old school nationalist. I don't think it's quite for me to go, yeah, this is the point at which he becomes a Nazi, but he certainly has a lot of racist among his followers, and he certainly does a lot of things to appeal to that crowd. And there's
basically
only
all
so
the,
far,
all the signs are there,
you know.
But he might or might not be one.
So if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck and wears a white hood, but
moving on from Trump a second, like, there's a really interesting definition of what fake news is in your book. I was wondering if you could just talk us through that real quick, because this isn't something that is just Donald Trump territory. This is all of our territory right now. And there have been a couple of examples that I've fallen for recently.
Yeah.
And some left-wing examples of fake news.
Yeah, I think the danger about talking about fake news as a term is it's someone else's problem. Mm. You know, I share a sort of a righteous story, you share fake news. Yeah. I keep fake news as a really, really tight definition of just a totally fabricated false story. Mm. I think the bigger problem is bullshit. And I don't just use that sort of to be snarky or because I like swearing. It's because there's a massive amount of stuff that is somewhere in between true and false. Mm. So, you know, fake news is a very weird claim. Well, actually, it's debatable whether even this is fake news. But in America, there was shared to several million people during the election race a conspiracy theory essentially saying that Obama had stockpiled 30,000 guillotines and had built an internment camp in Alaska.
Yeah.
Really, really handy Alaska if you want to drag people, that could fit 2 million people in.
Chop all their heads off.
And they were going to set up these guillotines and execute people at a rate of, I think, 1 million an hour. Now, the crazy thing about this is it's the most wild, obvious fake news you can imagine.
Yeah.
But they can click through to an invoice, which is a real government invoice, that says on it quantity 30,000 and has guillotines. And so is this totally fake news? Is this totally fabricated? No, because what that purchase order is for is for the little paper slicing things.
Amazing.
That you see.
This was your story, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You debunked this. It's mad that you'd even have to debunk that, but it's interesting that you did that.
Yeah, I covered this one quite extensively in the book, and it's this mad claim because no one's going to then believe it. And so if even a story like that isn't totally false, you then get to, you know, you can look at a Breitbart story saying Muslim mob sets fire to church.
Yeah.
And that one turned out to be a kind of protest attended by quite a lot of asylum seekers, refugees in Germany, predominantly Muslim. And they were setting off firecrackers as part of it. One of the firecrackers hit a tarpaulin on the perimeter wall of a church, not the actual church, and that tarpaulin set alight. Mm. And yeah. I believe from press reports, actually people in the crowd ran over, helped sort of stamp it out.
Right.
No damage, but there was a fire. There's a church. Whether something is a crowd or a mob is really up to, you know, the beholder. And it was Muslims. Is that fake news or is that just a really nasty, loaded twist on real events? Mm. And so I talk about bullshit as this idea that a narrative's the most important thing. It doesn't matter if it's true or false. It doesn't matter if it's somewhere between. It's just whatever sells your message best.
But we all fall victim to this. I remember before the American elections, I totally fell victim to the fake news of Trump sitting on a talk show saying if I was going to run for either party, it'd be Republican because their voters are such morons or something.
Yeah, because they have the dumbest voters.
They have the dumbest voters. And it was done up as if it was a subtitle over a picture of him on a talk show. And I fully thought I'd seen it.
Yeah.
I thought I'd seen a video of it.
Because you're so used to that format, it almost hacks your brain to be true. Words over a picture look way more true.
And then the other day, there was this thing in Parliament where apparently Conservative MPs had voted that animals didn't have sentience and they shouldn't be treated as sentient beings. And as soon as some, I remember, I'm kind of getting, I think, quite attuned to it. I'm starting to, my antennas getting more sensitive. Because when someone said that to me, I was like, that just doesn't smell right. And there was a kernel of truth, a bit like the church tarpaulin, you know, Muslim riot thing. Like, there was a kernel of truth and people had run with it. I read on BuzzFeed, it was the most viral news article in the last year?
In the entire year. Think about the things that have happened this year. You know, we've had this seismic political year. And the biggest story is, frankly, bollocks.
And it was on all the sort of 38 Degrees and all the VARs and all the different
petitions, everything. And, you know, no one at any point tried to actually knock down animal rights. There was never... The vote did nothing to change UK animal rights in any way. And, you know, and yet it also led to a formal ministerial statement.
From Gove, right?
Yeah.
But the point is we are all subject to this. We're all party to this. And we all think, it's just like you said, we think that we don't share fake news. We share righteous news. And because we believe in animal sentience, it sort of somehow justifies us sharing something that is quasi-true.
Yeah.
James, you know, the amount of times that I've, you know, had discussions about fake news, I mean, I'm totally, you know, losing count. Like, what can be done about it? What is the solution? Where are we going if there is no solution?
So a lot of it is trying not to reward places that make it. So things like working out, how are they monetizing? If it's a total fake news site, can you get Google and Facebook, who operate the main ad networks, can they get it off there? But for most of us, really, like, the big thing that we can do sounds so wildly boring. It sounds like nothing. Count to five slowly before you share anything on social media. And it just gets you past, because the fake news you fall for is something that outrages you.
Yeah.
Or something where you think, we have to fix this, or how dare they, or you know, we need to do something. So, you know, if you're left wing, you're not going to fall for sort of Tory fake news and vice versa. And that 5 second pause just lets your brain kick in and go, hang on. Is this too good to be true? Is someone else written this up as well? You know, have I checked this out?
Triangulation. There's a lot of people talk about that. You should get 3 different sources for one story, preferably sources from different political perspectives. And only when you've triangulated those 3, come to a conclusion.
Yeah, it's just that sense of, is this, you know, there's not one outlet that has the definitive version of the truth. And it's that thing of, have you checked it out enough?
Mm.
And things like, have you checked the web address? You know, is it a real one? And usually any story that relies on someone being a mustache-twirling villain, possibly with the exception of some US politics right now, is unlikely to actually stand up.
Ah, that was tasty.
I mean, that was a
tasty starter.
And it's really nice, actually, to hear someone talk about, you know, ways to solve it, because we've so much talked about kind of the problem of
I think it's up to all of us. It's up to all of us to think about these things. We're so constantly triggered with stuff that is just trying to get us to... Just to stay on this for 1 second, what do you think about this? The Boris Johnson story recently. Okay, fine, he's a moron. He's a buffoon, and he said something stupid in a meeting. Nobody during the entirety of the run of that story was saying, hold on a second, press, you have a hand in this. This woman's life is being put in danger, partly because you want clicks for stories about how stupid Boris Johnson is. It's the press's responsibility, surely, also to calm things down. If a woman's life is in danger, you know,
well,
don't make it the front page of every newspaper.
I think it's a very serious matter of public interest.
Absolutely.
If a mistake by the Foreign Secretary, the UK's chief diplomat, causes a worsening of a situation, and it was such a silly mistake that, you know, I think there is a very clear and strong public interest in raising that warning and that alarm, because otherwise you could essentially say anytime you publicise a mistake, you make it worse.
Yeah, I'm totally with James.
And so it can take you to a dangerous place. But what I will say is, in situations like that, the media do also follow the guidance of the authorities and of the families.
Yeah.
And if the families say, actually, at the moment, like, our lawyers and our advisors say, you know, don't publicise the case.
Do you think that happened?
There are very few outlets that don't. And so I think my understanding is, in this instance, the family were quite keen for publicity because they wanted public pressure to make the government here do more just for her in the first place, let alone before Boris kind of compounded the mistake. So I think generally you can get to a very dangerous place quickly if you start saying publicity makes it even worse, because that's, you know, that fuels every cover up in history. You can tell yourself you're doing a good thing by keeping it hushed.
What are we going to have for our metaphorical main?
Well, it's handy that we've talked about Boris because he's quite central for our main, which is, of course, $350 million a week.
I mean, of all the claims that were ever made at any point in my lifetime, I think it is the most terrible and yet genius move that anyone has ever made.
So the amazing thing about $350 million, and, you know, I really get into the weeds in this in the book, is it was bait. It was a trap. It was the juicy worm on the hook, because it made Remain campaign, it made journalists, it made everyone feel very clever trying to pick it apart. And if you try and do it on the technicalities, you end up with an argument that sounds a little bit like this. Well, there is an ostensible headline figure that we send £350 million a week to the EU, but we actually get a rebate that Margaret Thatcher negotiated before the 92 Maastricht Treaty, and it's quite hard to say exactly what it'll be because it depends on the relative GDP growth of the UK versus the other 27 nations in the EU, but it's usually about £95 million a year, so it'd be much fairer for us to talk about £255 million a week. But then, of course, we also get actual money back as EU investment. We get regional development funds, structural funds, we get EU education grants, and of course agriculture subsidies, as we all know, and they amount to about £80 million a week. So really, if we're being accurate, we should talk about £175 million a week, at which point
wow, I just got a kind of whole interdimensional view of like a different dimension in which James Ball is actually like a Mandarin at the Foreign Office, and he's sort of like,
but he's lost the argument as soon as he makes that convoluted argument. You've lost.
Well, yeah,
and I mean, Boris Johnson has won.
Like, that sails over your head. That, and also, and like, on top of everything else, someone's got a nice clear message that makes a nice 10-second clip. I sound like I've swallowed a dictionary of economics and, you know, possibly three sleeping pills.
I thought you sounded lovely, actually.
So, you're very charming, Jolyon. So, but, and the bigger thing as well is your instinct to quibble on the figures means that it sounds like all you're saying is, yes, we give the EU money every week, but it's 175 million instead of 350. And most people will go, well, hang on.
Yeah.
175 million a week for the NHS would be pretty good. You totally, totally end up accepting their premise, the thing that they want in your head. You know, we send money to Europe every week and that's bad. And so we kind of, by making it false, by making it so exaggerated, they actually sort of made Remain and a lot of independent journalists who were trying to sort of get out the truth, they made them into vehicles for the message, which wouldn't have worked if they'd have used an accurate number. And the guys behind that had done it in a previous campaign where they said it was when we were having a referendum on changing the voting system to AV, and they said AV would cost £200 million. And they then did posters with, you know, a tiny premature baby holding a finger and saying, she needs an incubator, not a new voting system. And again, on that one, the opposing campaign quibbled with the 200 million figure rather than giving their own messages. And so this is sort of the interesting thing on fake news and misinfo for me. You can very easily just end up trying to pick holes in someone else's narrative and you never tell your own story. And that's not how we tackle these things, as kind of Remain's defeat showed. You know, they went into that campaign with a lead and lost because all they could really do was sort of quibble on Leave's talking points. And of course, we've now ended up in a position where we're set to pay a £50 billion exit bill, and where there's been a new analysis by a couple of academics this week that hasn't actually had much attention, but says already, because like our economic growth slowed down after Brexit, we are £300 million a week worse off as a nation now. And this is before we've left. So we've kind of landed ourselves in a bad place, but we've got to learn, or our politicians and our media has got to learn not to take the bait.
The thing is that's absolutely fascinating about this issue, and to an extent about fake news as well, is currently in this country, there are literally no advertising standards in terms of what you can say online. And so, for instance, when the Leave campaign was saying, you know, Turkey going to join the EU, well, there's already too many people here, there's basically nothing that can be done.
So here's the interesting thing. You're sort of nearly there on the, right, on the advertising issue. But if you say online, you know, this toothpaste will make you better at sex and you'll immediately pull.
Really?
That advert can be challenged and would be withdrawn.
Oh, shit.
So unless the toothpaste really did that.
I mean, that would be amazing.
I mean, that would be a hell of a toothpaste.
Where would you put the toothpaste?
What would it be called?
In your mouth?
So, sexy paste.
Wherever you like, Hayden.
I like it.
But political advertising is weirdly regulated in one way and weirdly completely not in another. And basically, if you make a false claim about a candidate, that's a criminal offence.
Wow.
It's not just libel. Wow. It's an actual criminal offence. And so journalists have to be insanely careful, like even more so than usual. When we're worried about libel, we're worried about all sorts. But anytime there's an election on, we have to look not to make a false claim about a candidate. So if you look, you won't ever see sort of Theresa May eats babies and I saw it as an online advert.
True, by the way.
But you might hear, you know, Labour will bankrupt the nation.
So there's no regulation on that.
That's not about a candidate. And so that's kind of the amazing thing. No one will step in and sort of say this advert is false and can't run. And that's a gap in the rules that we can fix. I mean, there's other easy stuff with adverts, which is, given that we're all kind of worried about micro-targeting, this idea that, hey, you can send out different messages and dog whistle people and do that stuff. Just say any advert from anyone during an election that's political, like from one of the places already regulated, must be immediately posted in a public place as well as in a private one. And, you know, whack on some good fines and sanctions for that.
Mm.
And you take out that fear quite a lot.
I think for me, anyway, the most depressing sort of thing about all of this is simultaneously reading that 75% of people in the UK think that Brexit absolutely needs to happen, there should be a second referendum, and
75,
and that there's now, you know, much more movement for and much more pressure on the Electoral Commission to look into the way that particularly using sort of online memes, you know, messages like this were spread and targeted and broke a lot of rules allegedly. Do you think that anything can sort of come out of the Electoral Commission really investigating this?
So I think the key thing is for us not to get too obsessed on particular investigations. What matters really is the rules next time. I mean, one thing that's difficult for anyone on the Remain side, who, especially people who think Brexit's going really quite badly, and there's quite a lot of people, one thing that's difficult to remember is it did win by quite a lot of votes. You know, there were sort of several million in it. And this wasn't on a knife edge where sort of 50,000 changed minds matter.
Mm.
And so we've got to remember it's simultaneously possible that people knew what, you know, people made the choice that they had in front of them, but that also there was manipulation and bad behaviour. It doesn't mean, you know, it's not enough to say people did something wrong, therefore the vote's invalid. So we can look at the investigation. If people have broken the rules, they should be punished, and they are ongoing now. But the thing that we can fix is actually electoral law, because it's so out of date. And as we saw with things like election expenses, it's so ambiguous and so weird and so complex that they never actually, so far, they've not really prosecuted most cases when people have broken it. And so the obvious thing that we have to do is completely rewrite that law.
Mm.
And MPs can do that. They can start doing that now. You could get a committee working on the legislation. You could do something cross-party. And we don't need to wait for an investigation for that. We all have an MP. We all have people we can contact to start doing that. And, it, you know, that's not about sort of looking backwards. That's going, hey, we've got a lot of elections coming. We know a lot of the problems that we're having on misinformation, on advertising, on overseas influence. Let's get the rules really good so that they're ready for this internet era, and also that if you break them, it's got consequences.
Mm. I've never actually asked you this, but what do you put down us leaving the European Union in that vote too?
So I think one thing it's really easy to forget in this country is we've gone more than 10 years now without a pay rise. people have had real economic stagnation, and people are kind of feeling like there's a real gulf. You know, the country's changed in lots of ways that makes people feel left behind. You know, they are financially left behind. When things are getting tougher for them every year, people look to immigration as an issue with it. People look to all sorts. We'd used Europe as a punching bag, essentially, for difficult, any unpopular decision a UK politician needed to do, and kind of knew was maybe a good idea, really, but they didn't want to have to defend it. They just blamed the EU for. So we had, you know, an obvious panto villain. We had a country that was quite out of touch, and essentially the only message that remained sent out was, hey, the status quo is great, let's defend it. And that's not a message that's got to connect with a lot of people. Well, and I think when people were angry at the establishment, when people have their own economic issues, I think trying to kind of go stick with the status quo, people are like, you know what, hang on, I've had enough of you all. I've had enough of all of this. I don't like immigration very much. I'm sick of being told what to do by Brussels. Yeah, okay, maybe it's a risk, but screw it. It's time to change something. You know, it can't be worse than this, can it? Yeah. And of course, it's entirely possible it can be a lot worse than this. But I don't find it hard to understand why a lot of people thought, you know what, screw it, let's roll the dice.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people knew they were taking a risk financially and in those ways and did it anyway.
Well, that's in a way why the fake news worked for the Leave campaign and not for the Remain campaign, because there was also fake news on the part of the Remain campaign saying, as soon as we vote Leave, the whole country is going to collapse. There's going to be pandemonium. Yeah, that was obviously bullshit. But it was like things were so bad for these communities anyway. They were just like, you know what? I don't care.
Yeah.
Just like change something.
And so I think, you know, that's why there was a tinderbox that things helped ignite. Mm. And so, you know, I think we can easily sort of spend all of our attention on looking at the internet and looking at sort of Facebook and Twitter bots, and none of it looking at, hang on, why did so much of the country feel so aggrieved in the first place?
So that was delicious.
That was
so
fantastic.
We're going to go move on to our dessert. Have we got a light dessert? I doubt it somehow.
Are you suggesting I'm relentlessly serious? How well, no. dare you?
I wouldn't possibly say that. I've seen you at a festival, young man.
Oh.
Hey.
Real talk.
Real talk.
No, I thought for dessert, let's talk Twitter and Russia.
Yeah, let's get
fun.
Into it.
And so I had some fun with this last week, in that we were just trying to have a little look through the list of bots that Twitter sent over to Congress, to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And we were just looking, trying to find, actually, have any of these tweeted about Brexit, which actually The Guardian did as well. And they, you know, did a perfectly nice job with that. But we were digging through.
Love that. Like,
touché.
Sort of like.
Slightly barbed
exactly.
compliment there.
It's like, not as well as BuzzFeed did, but, you know, that's so totally fine.
So they may have done it quicker. And so I'm just sulking because they're a bit ahead on that one. But when we were looking through, we kind of did, I really like a super basic bit of network analysis, which is just kind of looking at who retweets who a lot. And just by kind of going, hey, who did these accounts retweet a lot, but other people didn't very much?
Yeah.
And we sort of found this bunch of accounts in the data.
Yeah.
We had a look and they were still on Twitter and they were really obvious bots. And so we kind of looked through and it was this kind of network of German language Twitter bots that would mainly tweet about Angela Merkel being bad.
Right.
But they'd do it in the middle of like hashtag games that they were trying to start, you know, the first, or why I love autumn,
right.
or, you know, Wi-Fi names, which is a Twitter game I think I joined in on.
So like very mainstream
yeah.
hashtags
and
that
like,
we get.
Why I love autumn.
Yeah, that one.
Angela Merkel is total bitch. Why I love autumn.
That is exactly what they did with.
So what
one
was the
them.
Strategy behind that? They were just trying to get it seen
so
by as many mainstream.
They try and get that trending.
Yeah,
like so they try and get real users to do it so that people then looked at a hashtag. And so like about 8 in 10 of the messages would be, you know, because the grass goes a pretty colour and this kind of stuff. And then because it will be the end of Merkel this election.
Yeah,
you know, Wi-Fi names down with Merkel. This sort of
and where but, is, and where were they directed, those tweets? Who was following them? English voters? British voters?
So these were clearly mainly focused on German voters. But then weirdly, all of these Germans
German
on
election,
one
sorry.
Day,
yeah.
just for the 23rd of June, the day of the EU referendum, suddenly tweeted a whole bunch of English language memes about Brexit.
Right.
Like, one day only, on using all the different hashtags. And they were tweeting stuff like, you know, David Cameron with Peppa Pig running away as a meme.
Hashtag I love autumn. Just loving it.
And like all of this kind of, for one day only, they went big on Brexit. And we published a bunch of the memes. And then sort of during one of the primary debates, they tweeted a whole bunch of pro-Trump stuff in English. And they were clearly trying to get pickup on this one with a weird line. And so a bunch of the accounts did, we love Trump because he's gay.
And totally. Like, I love that. I love that about him.
Like photoshopped drag queen Trump, like Trump in front of a rainbow flag.
Safe.
All
that's
this
good.
Stuff.
I'm good. I really want to know more about this bot thing because I'd like to get some.
Yeah.
I'd really like to get some because my career is kind of like plateauing.
Okay.
And like my Twitter, I just really like some sort of like, oh my God, I wish Jolyon was like hosting the new British Daily Show. Hashtag I love autumn. Hashtag I really just love Jolyon Rubinstein's hair. So I just love to see him on BBC One a lot more.
For Jolyon's benefit, like, how do you get these bots? And also, do actual people follow the bots? And why do they not know they're bots?
This is kind of the interesting thing. Most of the bots that we ran into were crap.
Yeah, but what the fuck are they, man? What are they?
So they're semi-automated. So this is kind of the crazy thing. It's like basically just hacked together bits of software so that you can be logged into five or six accounts at once and retweet them.
Mm.
And
so who follows them?
These are pretty manual.
Normal
these ones,
people?
Almost no one.
Oh.
Some people do.
So what's the
but
point
of
retweeting
bots?
Stuff? Why is it useful for them to retweet
because
stuff?
Because hashtag I love autumn.
So this is one of the big things that is not like totally missed with this.
Yeah.
Almost every bot that you see is crap. Like they
so
just,
they're not really having any effect. They're trying to subvert these the referendums and elections, but they're really just shit.
Yeah. And so this is kind of my thing. It's like when you actually look at them, they're pretty crap. They're sort of semi-automated stuff that clearly there's some human involvement, but it's just really a bunch of tools to make multiple Twitter accounts easier to manage.
So did they have any impact, do you think, in your
opinion? As far as we can see from the ones we've discovered, and some researchers at City and the University of London did as well, they kind of said, look, one of the things to notice with these bots is they don't work very well.
Right.
So what was interesting with the ones we found last week was they were still on Twitter.
Mm. Right.
Like Twitter had missed them. They hadn't deleted them. They hadn't done anything. And so we sent pretty much the formal kind of judged up version of, hey, bro, these accounts, you know, the fuck. And Twitter sent us back a very charming no comment.
Oh, wow.
Really?
But suspended all 45 of the accounts.
Mm,
so they sort of went and took them all out.
I think, you know, more and more, these social media platforms, they need to step up. I mean, it is getting to a point now where, you know, they have changed the game so fundamentally that the self-regulation, I wrote a piece about this for Hunger magazine a while, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg has sort of said very, very clearly that you can share whatever you like on Facebook. And frankly, that just is not good enough anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that isn't really Facebook's stance anymore either. What's interesting now is I think something's coming with this. Like, I'm super on the team, you know, sound a bit like, you know, centrist dad Hayden over there.
Hayden is such a centrist dad. So, hashtag, I love autumn.
So it is, like, totally possible to completely believe that there were Russian bots on Twitter trying to influence public opinion, and that is a very bad thing, but they were pretty bad at it and it probably didn't change any outcomes. That doesn't mean that we don't need to tackle it, and really that is about working out how to get the networks to do it without kind of then totally stifling free expression. But they are having to come in front of Parliament now. There's a fake news inquiry that's really come onto it, and Damian Collins has been really aggressive in terms of getting them in front of him. The Senate Intelligence Committee is making Twitter turnover evidence. And, you know, they were not happy that basically two guys at BuzzFeed could find bots that Twitter's incredible intelligence sort of stuff couldn't. Well, and we did no rocket science, let me tell you.
Well, let me ask you a question, because just bringing it back to the first thing. So the President of the United States has just retweeted a video, as we said earlier, of what appears to be a Muslim in Holland beating up a boy that's a cripple. Now, a lot of people are going to see that and think that is real.
Yeah.
Now, in your opinion, should Twitter have the responsibility of saying,
this is false. We have evidence to suggest that this isn't in any way real. This is deleted automatically.
So I think Twitter have a special case with Donald Trump himself. I think.
Oh, yeah, they do, mate.
But I think the president of the United States having a direct and, you know, often quite scary, unfiltered view to the public. I think it's important to actually keep that there. I think it's important people see what Trump puts out when he doesn't have anyone in between him and the public, when he doesn't have someone glossing the message.
Well, even if it's release the missiles.
Oh, mate, please, no.
I think Trump is a special case. I think the question for me was the original account that Trump was retweeting, the deputy leader of Britain First, a far-right party that's by a few chains remove an offshoot of the National Front. Britain First is an offshoot of the BNP, which was part of the National Front. I mean, this is hardcore far-right stuff. Should Twitter be hosting that account?
And verifying her?
I think is very
questionable.
My God,
have they verified her?
I think that, she was verified before.
That's fucked up, man.
Why she had a blue tick is the thing that's just an indefensible
call. That's really
call.
Fucked up, because it's one thing having to trawl through millions and millions of tweets and work out what's fake and what's not. But don't, like, verify a fucking racist. That's
it's weird, isn't it? Because in a weird way, sort of silently, that currency, that blue tick currency, is quite a powerful thing for people. And I guess what I meant, James,
and Twitter have now acknowledged that blue tick kind of the sort of credibility it adds is important, because they actually de-verified a bunch of sort of far-right US accounts lately. But they've essentially left themselves now where their blue tick kind of marks the limit of what they're saying is acceptable. And they've got to get themselves out of that mess. But I look at that, you know, I looked through her Twitter feed today, and you do think, why on earth does this have a blue tick next to it? And even as kind of quite a pro-free speech person, and, you know, I think I don't want to turn into somewhere that silences everyone we disagree with, but I look at that feed and think, should this be on Twitter?
Yeah, totally.
And I really, really question whether it should be allowed to be posted at all, because it's, you know, it's information that could incite violence.
Exactly, and I think that's the key point.
And it's presented really inflammatorily. And so, yes, I think they really, really have to start looking at what they host. You know, why was that there for Trump to retweet?
The blue tick is like having the Force on Twitter. Don't give her that.
The dark side and the light. I do think
come on, you would take my blue tick out of my cold dead hand.
Listen, as long as Kylo Ren like comes through as like some bad boy Jedi, right? Like, I'm cool with all of this.
Yeah.
Just a bit of a Star Wars thing.
You're just geeking out there. Just mention Star Wars. Jolly goes off.
I just don't understand. Counting down the days. The other thing I wanted to ask you was, it seems to me that the power brokerages of, you know, whether it's the, you know, the right wing media seems to say even more incendiary things, because it's like the last death cry of, you know, an institution that's disappearing. You know, now we have YouTube, Twitter, Facebook becoming these mediums for people like Richard Spencer in the alt-right movement. And, you know, we're talking about Britain First here. They had literally no traction before these platforms. So what is the answer? Should there be like a supranational body that is governing sort of an efficacy thing here? I mean, you're very involved in this. So.
I mean, the issue that starts to kick in for me there is, you know, that would involve countries like China, which has very heavy censorship. It would involve a lot of Middle Eastern countries, which still punish homosexuality by death. It would involve Russia having a big seat at the table. It would also tap into every one world government conspiracy theory. But, you know, where that organization ended up setting the limits might be somewhere completely unacceptable to us. You know, that might legitimately, you know, they might assess their members and say, no, we don't think content that promotes gay rights should be acceptable on these networks. And so I think we have to look at the fact that it's complex and it's dangerous. I think if you want to look in practice at who can fully hold social networks to account, remember, Facebook's way bigger than any news organization ever has been, 2 billion people. It's basically the US government and the EU. And we're leaving one of them, and the other isn't going to do anything about it while this president's in power. So don't expect wonders.
Oh, good. Well, listen, that just
left a bit of a sour taste in the mouth for a dessert. Thanks, James.
But listen, you know, please, please, please check out James's books. Yeah. What's your hashtag again? I mean, not your hashtag, apart from, I love our term. What's your handle?
I am JamesRBUK on Twitter. Right.
And the book is called Post-Truth, was it again?
Post-Truth, How Bullshit Conquered the World.
That's it. Yeah. I've read it. It's very good.
Well, listen.
And if you ever have any questions about a story and whether it's fake news or real news, just tweet James and he's happy to respond.
Yeah.
True?
Well, listen.
Maybe.
Thank you so much for listening. We have only one more episode of this series of News Row, so I hope you've enjoyed it. See you soon.
Bye.